Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm sorry, I wish I could be there with you guys. I had planned on it, but just things didn't work out, so I'm stuck here in Nashville. And I'm going to talk with you a little bit about some work that we've been doing with this intramural needle ablation electrode. And I have I'm co-holder of a patent on that that's consigned to the Brigham Hospital, so I haven't received anything for it. So this relates to the problem of ventricular arrhythmias, which are, as you know, an important cause of sudden death in the U.S. There are about 350,000 sudden deaths annually in the U.S., and most of those are related to coronary ischemia that causes polymorphic ventricular tachycardia that degenerates to ventricular fibrillation. And most of what I'm going to be focusing on are ventricular arrhythmias that present as sustained monomorphic ventricular tachycardia. And most of these are due to reentry in areas of ventricular scar that may be due to an old infarct or replacement fibrosis from a cardiomyopathic process or an inflammatory process or prior cardiac surgery. And the best prevention method that we have for prevention of sudden death in people that have ventricular scars and are subject to these arrhythmias is to give them an implanted defibrillator. And there are about 9,000 or so defibrillators implanted every month in the United States, most of those in people who have not yet had a spontaneous episode of sustained VT, but who are felt to be at risk for ventricular tachycardia. And of the people that receive a defibrillator for those reasons, somewhere in the 20 to 30% of them will have a spontaneous episode of sustained VT within the next 3 years. And some of those folks will have recurrent episodes of ventricular tachycardia. So that's the patient population that we're really studying, the group that have these recurrent scar-related arrhythmias and have a defibrillator. And the defibrillator is a wonderful safety net. What it does, of course, is it just detects the occurrence of the arrhythmia and then it terminates ventricular tachycardia either by anti-tachycardia pacing, which I believe you had a discussion of, or applying a shock. But unfortunately, defibrillators don't prevent the arrhythmias from occurring, and the spontaneous episodes of VT have a negative impact on patients' quality of life. The shocks are painful, the arrhythmias may still be symptomatic, and interestingly, the occurrence of a spontaneous ventricular arrhythmia in a patient who has a defibrillator predicts increased mortality and heart failure hospitalization in those patients. So it's probably a marker in some people for disease progression and cardiac deterioration. So we still need therapies to prevent ventricular arrhythmias in people who have ventricular scars. So as I mentioned, the causes of scar-related VT, the most common one in the U.S. is myocardial infarction. Second most common are non-ischemic dilated cardiomyopathies, and this is a heterogeneous group of diseases. But many of these patients will develop areas of replacement fibrosis in the ventricle. And if that occurs in a manner that creates the appropriate anatomy to support reentry, then they get recurrent VT. There are some cardiomyopathies that particularly are prone to causing VT, arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, which is usually due to a mutation of a desmosomal protein, do that. And then other causes of scar that we mentioned. And so what's going on in these scars that cause VT? Well, there are areas of dense fibrosis where there are no surviving myocytes, and those define reentry paths and are probably border forming for some of the reentry circuits. And then interstitial fibrosis that separates out myocyte bundles likely also contributes to slow conduction and promote the type of anatomy that can facilitate conduction block in these areas, and those are probably the factors, some of the factors involved in promoting reentry in scars. Now, the challenge for interrupting these reentry circuits with catheter ablation are largely anatomic, and this is a cross-section through a heart from a patient who had recurrent ventricular tachycardia. And you can see that these white areas are regions of fibrosis. This is from an old infarct, and there are surviving myocytes within that region. And I just made up this possible circuit. I don't really know what the circuits were like in this patient. These discolored areas are regions of catheter ablation. This is coagulation necrosis of the myocardium produced by radio frequency current to heat resistively heat the tissue. And you can appreciate from this that the potential area over which the reentry circuit may have occurred was pretty large, and it extends deep within the myocardium, so that when you approach this region from the endocardial surface of the heart, these lesions may not be able to interrupt the reentry circuit. And we have methods of going to the epicardial surface as well, so we could potentially have gotten out here to the epicardial side. And you can appreciate that out here there's a layer of fat. It may be an obstacle to ablating the circuit. And the parts of the circuit are deep to the epicardial surface as well. So these intramural components to the reentry circuit are a problem in terms of both identifying the location of the circuit and ablating it to interrupt reentry. So there are subendocardial, subepicardial, and intramural portions of these scar-related reentry circuits in many patients. And we can interrupt some of the subendocardial components pretty effectively by ablation with a catheter placed at the endocardium. But very often in these people with large areas of scar, once you do that, you find that they still have other potential reentry circuits provocable. And so when you repeat pacing to try and provoke a VT, you find that they have other VTs that are inducible. So to try and deal with these intramural components, we have now access to this catheter, which has a 27-gauge needle that can be extended out the tip of the catheter. And the needle is irrigated, it has a lumen. And there's another, we also irrigate the lumen through which the needle passes in the catheter. And this can be then deployed into the myocardium, and we can apply radio frequency current directly on the needle. Now, if we do that, it creates a long, thin lesion. But if you irrigate the needle, if you irrigate in a way that you distribute saline into the tissue, that appears to create a large virtual electrode in the tissue, and you could get these deep intramural sizable RF lesions. This is endocardium here, epicardium out here. And you can see that the lesions are also different from our usual type of radio frequency lesions where we're ablating on the endocardium, and you get kind of a semicircular lesion that hugs the endocardium. Here we've got endocardial sparing, and the lesion is deep within the tissue. So we've now been using this in people, and I'll show you a little bit of data gleaned from the initial 31 patients that we've studied in the U.S. with this technology. And the problems are, how do you find the target when it's deep within the tissue? How do you get the needle there? And then how do you know that you've made a lesion? And then, of course, we're poking the heart with this 27-gauge needle, so there's some important safety concerns with that. Is this a safe thing to do? So we can identify the target potentially from pre-procedural imaging by finding the areas of scar on MRI imaging, and areas of fibrosis are detectable as regions of delayed gadolinium enhancement. ECG, the simple electrocardiogram of the VT, gives us quite a bit of information. It's pointing us to the region of the heart that likely contains the scar. And then in the electrophysiology laboratory, moving these catheters around the heart, recording the electrical activity, mapping is traditionally how we identify our target areas. And when we do that with the needle catheter, we have these potential recordings. If we deploy the needle into the myocardium, I'll show you these recordings that are from the needle and the dome electrode. So the dome electrode will be resting on the endocardial surface. The needle electrode is a single solid piece of nitinol. So we don't have micro electrodes along this. We're recording from that entire piece of metal. And we can record in a unipolar configuration where the indifferent electrode is an electrode in the inferior vena cava remote from the heart, or in bipolar configurations where we're recording between the needle and the dome electrode, or the needle and the ring electrode, both of these being on the endocardial aspect of the myocardium. So the first thing we usually do is create an anatomic map of the ventricle. And this is shown here. In this case, these are nice images from Katja Kreppenfeld's group at the University of Leiden, and they've taken an MR image and registered the electrical information obtained from the EP lab on that image. So this purple chamber is the outline of the left ventricle, and the colors reflect the amplitude of the electrograms. And purple is a normal amplitude electrogram, and these red, green, yellow regions are low amplitude signals, and this indicates the presence of a region of scar at this part of the heart. So where you've got areas where the myocardium's been replaced by fibrosis, electrogram amplitude is of course lower. And in some patients who have intramural areas of scar, what you'll see is a normal appearing endocardium to the bipolar electrogram voltage. But if you look at the unipolar electrograms, which have a further field of view, there will be regions of relatively low amplitude unipolar electrograms suggesting the presence of intramural scar, and that's what's shown here. And in the epicardium, there was a large area of low voltage, so there was scar that extended from intramurally out to the epicardium, and this is the reconstructed MRI image. The brown regions are areas of delayed gadolinium enhancement, which likely represent fibrosis. So if we can do pre-procedure imaging, we can likely identify the scar. And then in the lab, we create these voltage maps to try and define where there are areas of intramyocardial fibrosis. So this is another set of voltage maps from a patient who had a non-ischemic dilated cardiomyopathy and recurrent VT. This is for LV. And you can see that the it's all purple, so that's a normal amplitude electrogram. This is the unipolar voltage map, and there are all these very extensive regions of low voltage suggesting that although the endocardial surface looked relatively normal, that there's likely scar deep to the endocardium. This is the epicardial voltage map. And there's a little bit of low voltage back along the mitral annulus, but most of the ventricle looks pretty normal. So that suggests that most of the scar in this patient giving rise to her VTs is really intramural in location. But it's quite a sizable area, so we still have the problem of where do we go to ablate the VTs. And some of that we obtain by looking at the characteristics of the VT. So the data that I'm going the examples I'm going to show you are acquired following this kind of a workflow. So first have a creation of a ventricular map, which shows us the anatomy and the electrogram amplitudes. We'll do VT and look at that information. And then at sites where we think we may be close to the VT, we'll place our needle catheter and insert the needle into the myocardium. And then we'll look at the electrograms from the needle. We can pace on the needle and directly depolarize the tissue in contact with the needle. Then, to confirm that we're actually in the tissue, we inject a mixture, contrast and saline, and we stain the tissue. And this has been kind of interesting. And then if everything looks favorable, then we go ahead and apply radiofrequency current on the needle as we're continuing to irrigate saline into the tissue. And after we feel we've created a lesion, we stop irrigation, we reassess spacing on the needle to try and determine if we've made a lesion. What we expect is that we can no longer capture the tissue when we pace at that site if we've really created a lesion. And I'm going to show you some evidence of detection of intramural arrhythmia substrate in humans. And the evidence for that is going to be that there are sites where we can pace on the needle, even though the overlying tissue is fibrotic and you can't capture pacing on the endocardial surface at that site. We have sites where we see electrograms on the needle, but not on the overlying myocardium on the endocardial surface. And then I'm going to show you some patterns of contrast distribution when you inject the saline contrast directly into the tissue that suggests that the tissue is quite heterogeneous in some patients. So this first set of data is from a patient who has cardiomyopathy due to a Lamin mutation. And this is a pretty bad type of cardiomyopathy. They get very extensive areas of fibrosis and VEs that are often very difficult to control. And so the first thing that we did is we created this voltage map, and this is the left ventricle. It's kind of viewed from its inferior surface, and most of this area of low voltage, the red, yellow, green, is the septum of the ventricle, and you can see there's very extensive low voltage all along the septum. And then we deployed the needle after seeing what the VTs looked like. We went to the area of the septum that we thought was going to be close to where they originate from. And this is an X-ray image of the needle catheter, which is here. The needle, which you can't really see, extends into the tissue. And this little blurred gray region here is the contrast staining of the tissue. So you can see that when we injected contrast, we stained this part of the septum, which is coming up through the right atrium, through the tricuspid valve to the right side of the septum. This catheter is actually over in the left ventricle. And then this is the same catheter position just viewed from the right anterior oblique projections as though standing to the patient's right and looking in on the septum, and you can see there's this pretty sizable cloud of tissue staining. So we can assess when we're in the tissue with staining. We also have an intracardiac ultrasound imaging probe, which is in the ventricle. And this is we can't always see the needle tip very well, but this is an image from a different patient that in whom we could see the needle pretty well. This is the catheter, in this case, into the left ventricle, and this right thing here, this is the needle extending into that patient's septum from the right ventricle. So back to the Lamin cardiomyopathy patient. So here's a recording from one of the septal sites. And this top electrogram recording is from the is a bipolar recording from the dome and ring electrode. You can see that there's not really any signal there. That's been very extensively ablated previously. But on the needle electrogram, which are these actually four channels, you see that there's a little low amplitude signal. And during these couple of beats of ventricular reentry, that signal precedes the onset of the QRS. Now, the way that we induced that arrhythmia was actually pacing from the needle. And you can see when we pace on the needle, probably are capturing this tissue, and as you don't see any electrogram there, and pacing does capture, and there's a bit of delay between the stimulus and the QRS onset, which is consistent with slow propagation of a wavefront out away from where we're pacing. So this suggests that we've identified an area of intramural surviving myocardium that is deep to an endocardial scar, and where we can capture, it's clearly viable tissue, and activation can occur in diastole relative to this, these couple of reentry beats, suggesting that that could be arrhythmogenic. Here's another example. In this example, again, where the needle's deployed in the septum, we're pacing in the septum, and there's a little bit of delay between stimulus artifact and the QRS, which is due to depolarization of enough myocardium that you can detect it from the body surface. When we stop pacing here, this patient has complete heart block, so when we stop pacing on the needle, pace on a different catheter where his pacemaker paces. And you can see that there's this nice signal that's present on the needle electrodes, and it's not visible from the endocardial electrode. So again, evidence of an intracardiac substrate. Now, before I showed you the needle deployed in the septum from the right ventricle, here this catheter goes through the mitral valve and comes at the septum from the left ventricle. So this is a little lower area on the septum. Again, you see a smaller region of staining compared to what we saw before. This is the orthogonal view, looking down the barrel of the ventricle as though you're standing at the patient's left. And there's this small area of staining in the ventricular septum. And not all of the electrograms that we see in the intramural from intramural sources of arrhythmia are these nice discrete electrograms. Here's one that you see this kind of low amplitude, really almost artifactual looking kind of signal on the needle electrodes, nothing on the endocardium. The interesting thing, the reason we think this was probably relevant is when we stuck the needle in the myocardium here and reported that, as we started injecting, the tachycardia slowed and stopped. And this is actually very common, that if you just start spearing myocardium where the arrhythmia circuits are, the VTs go away just from the mechanical interaction and the injection of saline. And I thought when we started this project, I'd have all these nice examples where we put the needle into the tissue and we have nice recordings of VT and pacing maneuvers during VT. But in fact, if you put the needle into an area and it's really the right area, often those VTs kind of go away just as a consequence of injecting saline into the tissue. Here's an example of a site where when you pace on the endocardium, you don't capture anything. You have high pacing output, but if you put the needle in beneath that, you do capture. So again, evidence of surviving intramural substrate with an overlying area of dense fibrosis. So this is a case from a couple of weeks ago. This is the type of information that we're looking at in the electrophysiology laboratory. It's just kind of a large composite screen. See, this is the intracardiac ultrasound image. This is the left ventricle here. This is a large papillary muscle from the coil apparatus connecting to the mitral valve. This is a voltage map of the left ventricle, and this patient has a large septal region of low voltage from a prior infarct. And they had recurrent ventricular tachycardia that had failed a couple of prior ablation attempts. And this, whoops, go back one here, is, this is the activation map of the VT that, that had not been successfully ablated. This is the left ventricle here, this is the right ventricle, and the colors in this case, rather than indicating the electrogram amplitude, this these colors indicate activation time during VT. So this indicates early activation on both the left and the right sides of the septum, and then activation spreads out away from that region. So this was a VT that was coming from within the septum in that large area of scar, but ablation on the endocardial surfaces of the left and right ventricle had not abolished it. And interestingly, where we found it was not where that area of early activation was, but it was actually back here at the kind of posterior border of the scar, where we were able to deploy the needle into the tissue from the right side of the septum and interrupt the VT. So the circuit was likely quite large. The exit broke through, appeared to break out down towards the apical end, but the circuit was where it could interrupt it with intramural ablation was more proximal to that. So these are the kind of anecdotal cases that have been interesting and show feasibility for this kind of an approach. One of the other interesting things that we've observed is how variable the contrast saline distribution within the tissue is when you just insert the needle and inject saline contrast. And these are examples of that. So here's an example where we've got a small region of contrast. This is kind of what I thought we would usually see, is a little area of saline accumulation at and around the electrode. But sometimes you'll see this sort of thing where the saline is tracked into the tissue and it's clearly identified a tissue plane and it distributes like this. Here's another quite heterogeneous distribution of contrast tissue. You can imagine perhaps this is an area of scar. And one of the interesting things in looking about at these is the reason that we're able to convince our industry partner to make this catheter was they had already made a catheter that they had created specifically to inject biologically active substances into the myocardium, and that was what they were planning to do with it. You could insert the needle and then inject. And of course, people have been injecting various things, skeletal myoblasts and stem cells. And from this sort of work, I think you can appreciate that when you put a needle into the myocardium and you inject, you don't really know where that stuff is going and how it's distributing in the tissue. So perhaps some of the disappointing results that have occurred with attempts to repopulate various scarred myocardium with functioning myocytes relates to the fact that you can't really control the distribution of the ejectate into the tissue. And I think we see examples of that pretty clearly from our work with this needle catheter. And then finally, you know, we're very worried about safety. That's been the big focus of the studies in this initial cohort of patients. And we've seen that we can create AV block in the ablated in the septum. That's expected because some VTs originate from the septal myocardium. And the big thing that we've been worried about is perforation, poking this needle that's as long as a centimeter into the myocardium. And we have had one episode of pericardial effusion that was significant, and I'll show you that case. It's kind of interesting. So this was from a patient who had a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy and very frequent PVCs and non-sustained VT that occurred with sufficient frequency that it was contributing to cause her ventricular dysfunction. And it had not been able to be ablated. It had intramural origin from up near the aorta. And when we inserted the needle into that area and injected contrast, we had suppression of the arrhythmia. And that's what you see here. There are the PVCs. You inject the saline and it goes away. So we thought, oh, we must be, you know, very close. We applied RF current. And the arrhythmia would stay gone for a period of several minutes, and then it would recover. So we explored that area pretty extensively. And this is a catheter that comes up through the aorta, and then the needle is inserted into the base of the ventricular myocardium here. You can see after repeated injections of saline and contrast, we have a relatively large area here of contrast staining. And what we observed was that kind of extended, and as we were watching on intracardiac ultrasound, we saw that we began developing some pericardial fluid, which is this clear area around the heart, and a bleb. This little outpouching here should not normally be there. That is a collection of fluid that was developed in the epicardial surface, kind of like a little blister. And as we watched, it popped. And now you see there's this little rim of probably the visceral pericardium that is become more mobile, and there's perhaps just a little more pericardial fluid. So at that point, we reversed the anticoagulation and we put a needle in and drained this fluid. There wasn't really all that much and it stopped. It didn't continue to bleed. We did not need to leave a drain in. And following day, her echocardiogram was essentially normal with minimal pericardial fluid. And eventually her PVCs went away as well, even though they were still present at the procedure. So we've done this in 31 patients with difficult to control arrhythmias who failed other methods of ablation. Most of them have non-ischemic form of cardiomyopathy. And overall, the results have been kind of promising. About 68% of people are either free of VT or pretty substantially improved. And the substantially improved is largely people that had very frequent or incessant VT before, but now have a rare episode of VT afterwards. So we're pretty encouraged with the feasibility of this method, but there are some pretty significant challenges. So what I've shown you, I hope, this morning is that these intramural scars are a source of ventricular tachycardia for some people that create difficult to control arrhythmias. We need some improvements in technology to learn how to better identify these areas. Perhaps some of the elegant modeling work that Natalia Trinoa and her colleagues have been doing would be helpful in this regard. And then finally, the injection of substances into the myocardium is perhaps a little bit more complex than one might initially think, and has implications for injecting other biologically active materials and perhaps other agents to try and ablate myocardial tissue in the future. Thank you very much. Okay, I can hear you quite well.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Bill?
Yes, I can.
Okay. This is Hiroshi Afrika from Johns Hopkins. Thanks for a great talk, Bill. I'm sorry you cannot be here with us to have fun with us.
Thank you.
I have two questions. You didn't show the typical entrainment map for your VT case, but I assume that's because this particular patient's VT was hemodynamically unstable. But if you have a classic hemodynamically stable VT case, can you do the classic entrainment mapping for the patient with intramyocardial needle?
Yes, you can. And part of the reason, I do have a few examples, but interestingly, I don't have very many examples, partly for the reason you say most of these have hemodynamically untolerated VT. But the other thing that happens is that when you insert the needle and inject saline, if you're in the region of the reentry circuit, the VT usually becomes no longer inducible or you induce some other VT. So I thought I'd have a lot of nice examples of entrainment pacing from the needle. But in fact, usually that arrhythmia becomes not inducible just as a consequence of the saline injection. And I don't think the saline injection is creating any permanent injury. I would guess that if we stopped at that point and did not deliver an RF lesion, that would simply just heal and VT would be back. So we go ahead and we apply the RF, but it has made assessment of the ablation effect also a little bit more challenging, because when the VT is no longer there, did we really create a permanent injury to the reentry circuit that abolished it, or is it just a consequence of the tissue edema we've created, and once that resolves, the VT will be back.
All right, thank you. The second question is that you show two cases of an LV summit approach. One is a retrograde aortic approach, and then the other was from RV septum. I have in the last 6 months, I had three failed attempts of LV summit PVC cases, and I just want to get your insights as to with your needle ablation catheter, what's your decision tree as to how to approach the LV summit area?
Yes, we've had some. I guess three of those in our series, and there are a couple of more that Vivek Reddy has done, and we're actually putting those together because we've been very pleased that we've had some of these were patients who have failed multiple ablation procedures. It's due to its deep neural location in the summit, where we can reach it either from the right ventricular side coming down from above or from the endocardial surface. So we're optimistic that this is going to be very useful for that group of patients. You know, it's a small number. And in the one that I showed you who developed the infusion, one of the interesting things about her was she was still having occasional PVCs at the end of the case. So when you see that, usually that means you failed, and we thought we had failed. But once that healed, PVCs went totally away, and she's now drugs in over a year out, no arrhythmia. So there was some late healing effect that abolished her arrhythmia.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Fabio Fenton. Very nice talk.
Thank you.
How much the amount of liquid that you inject? How many? What's the volume? It's always the same, or is
It's a fair amount, interestingly. So we initially inject 1 cc of a 50-50 saline contrast mix, and then if we decide we're going to ablate there, we infuse another 2 cc, so a total of 3 milliliters of fluid. And then while we're ablating, we're continuing to inject 2 mLs a minute. So, and we usually ablate for 90 seconds. So they wind up, receiving 5 or 6 mLs of fluid into a relatively small area. One of the surprises, perhaps, in that we haven't had more cases where we created some intramyocardial edema or perhaps initiated a distinct hematoma. It seems like the myocardial lymphatics really accommodate this very well. It must relate to, in part to the structure of the ventricular myocardium arranged in sheets that saline just generally disperses relatively quickly. And after we inject the contrast, you usually see, within 20 minutes or so, there's usually no further evidence of contrast in the tissue when you look fluoroscopically.
So, and you think you change locally somehow the physiology of the cells because of the saline, there's no other components there, or?
Yeah, I think it must, since we see the arrhythmias become quiescent when we inject the saline. And that's something I hadn't really thought about at all. What are the electrophysiologic consequences of tissue edema? Now, and I don't know if anybody knows very much about that, you know?
I guess it could be done in isolated myocytes. You could inject the same thing and see what happens.
Or there's people experiments and see what happens.
Yeah, it would be interesting, and it would be interesting to know if creating tissue edema like that, how it modifies the susceptibility of the cells to injury. You know, we're injuring the cells with resistive heating, a thermal kind of injury, but maybe there would be other options as well. In tissue edema, I could envision maybe you create some tissue edema and that increases the susceptibility to a freezing injury. Then maybe what we should be doing is injecting saline and freezing rather than burning.
Hmm. This is Leon Glass. Thanks for the talk.
Yes, Leon.
So you were talking about doing ablation for PVCs and showed one particular case. So in that case, do you know anything about the mechanism of the PVCs that were present? And also more generally, to what extent are the PVCs just potentially harmful because they're there, leading to poor ventricular function in some sense? Or to what extent may they be involved in the VT episodes themselves, either initiating or being a re-entry beat that doesn't take off to the tachycardia?
Yes, we think that that it was some type of a focal mechanism, because we did not record any diastolic activity other than immediately presystolic anywhere in the region where we were close to the circuit, and those PVCs did not respond to pacing. way that suggested they were reentrant. I don't know if it was abnormal automaticity. It didn't really behave so much like prig automaticity in that when you burst in pace, it would suppress. And when it didn't seem to really have much of a predictable relationship between the coupling interval of recovery and pacing, although we didn't really look at that very carefully. But I think some type of focal automaticity in that area. In that particular patient's case, she had a lot of PVCs, more than a third of her beats during a 24-hour period would be these PVC. And it was felt that was contributing to cause ventricular dysfunction in her case. She had also had runs of VT that had produced syncope in the past, although that was largely suppressed amiodarone, which she was on at the time of the procedure. So we didn't see her VT, although previously it had had a morphology on EKG, which looked similar to the PVCs. So in her case, I think it was causing contributing to depressed ventricular function. I'm sure that there are cases where the PVC is the potential triggering mechanism for other arrhythmias. It seems like pretty often when you have a scar-related sustained VT and the patient has frequent PVCs, often the PVC originates also from the scar pretty close to or within a region that seems to give rise to the VT. So you wind up in some people taking care of both arrhythmias when someone has frequent PVCs and scar-related VT. There are others where the PVCs are far away from where the VT comes from, but both situations seem to occur.
Thank you.
Hi, Bill, this is Alan Karma. But yeah, we won't get to play golf this time, but it's okay.
I know, I was disappointed. I'm sorry I can't be there with you guys.
So, you know, in the beginning of the talk, you showed a cross-section of the myocardium with kind of a hand-drawn circuit where it looks sort of two-dimensional in the cross-section. I'm just wondering, three-dimension, it's the circuits can be quite complicated. And so what I didn't really get from the talk is how do you go about mapping? Is there any effort to map the circuit before ablation? So that's one question. Second question is how many poking with the needle do you do? Let's say if you poke once and it's not successful, how many lesion do you do typically in the cases that you looked at? And then the third question was, this cell line injection seemed to terminate the arrhythmias, but at the same time you said it doesn't always go, it goes in an unpredictable region. So let's say it goes into a region where it terminates the arrhythmia, but if you're going to do an ablation, you're not going to be ablating the region where the cell line contrast has gone and terminate the arrhythmia. So then do you go back and poke into that region where it terminated the VT?
Yes.
So that's our three questions. I don't know if you remember the first one.
Yes. Okay. I'll do the last one first.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very worried about that because if you inject a saline and it goes someplace remote from the needle and terminates the tachycardia, and then we ablate. And that doesn't create a permanent lesion where the tachycardia is originating from. And if the edema resolves and the tachycardia recurs, well, then we'll recognize that and we'll get a chance to address it. But if the edema doesn't resolve during that procedure, if it's a couple hours later or something, then we won't recognize that we didn't fix the problem. So I am worried about that, and I wonder if some of the patients who have had recurrences after ablation, that's part of what's going on. So it would be nice to have, we need to do some further investigation into, I think, the electrophysiologic effects of injecting saline into tissue and edema. And we're trying to do some work looking at what maybe what determines how that contrast distributes in the tissue, and how we might use that to kind of guide ablation. Like one could imagine, if you inject and it has an electrophysiologic effect that's beneficial, but yet the contrast is distributed out away from where you injected, maybe we should pull the needle back, redeploy, and then and insert the needle closer to where the cloud of contrast is located.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So we're hoping to initiate a series of investigations in an experimental in an animal model of infarction, try and look at some of these issues. Regarding how many times we can insert it, it's pretty interesting. It's a 27-gauge needle, so it's quite small. And we saw that in our animal work that you could insert it multiple times, and then when you take the heart out, you can't see where you've been. So in patients, we have had patients where we've inserted the needle more than 60 times in the myocardium. And, you know, if we insert the needle and then we, site doesn't look favorable for ablation, if we pinch and it doesn't capture or it doesn't seem like it's near the VT, then we simply withdraw the needle back into the catheter. And it seems so far that's safe. And I think that it's because the needle is so small and the myocardium is so forgiving. I'm sure that if we, you know, if we used the needle kind of like a knife, like if it got, it had substantial lateral motion to it, that maybe we could lacerate tissue. But it doesn't seem like that's happening. And also trying to watch carefully on intracardiac ultrasound to make sure that we have good stability and that we're just inserting the needle directly into the myocardium. And then the mapping piece of things has been a little more difficult than I had hoped, in part because of that issue of when you put the needle into the tissue and inject the saline, the arrhythmia often will stop, and then you don't have it to map more. And often these situations we're kind of a little bit desperate because these are patients who failed other ablation procedures. So if we think that we're close to the circuit and it's in an area of scar where we feel ablation is safe, we go ahead and ablate at that area. So our mapping information from the needle so far has been less than I had hoped that we would be acquiring because of that.
But you need to inject the saline to record. You cannot just record from the electrode.
Oh, no, we can record. No, we can record without injecting the saline.
Okay.
We can. Yeah. So you're right that often when we first put the needle in, if we're in DT when we first put the needle in, we do get to see those electrograms. I think I showed you one that was kind of like that. So we, and if we see that, but then if it looks favorable, if we put the needle in and the electrogram looks like we're possibly in the circuit, then we pace, and we want to ablate there, so then we inject the saline, and then the arrhythmia usually will, if we're at a good spot, it will usually slow down and stop.
But are there cases where you actually map a reentrant circuit?
We haven't defined a complete reentrant circuit intramurally. We have cases when the circuit's on the endocardium or the epicardium, we have some nice examples of a complete reentry circuit. Not a large number of patients, because often these folks don't tolerate their VT long enough to leave them in for very long. So more often we're finding just components, portions of the circuit, looking for the portion where when we interrupt conduction through that area will interrupt entry. But we have not yet defined a complete intramural circuit with the needle yet. I'm hoping for that that case. Yep, you.
Probably go ahead, George Tech. So one thing that I did not completely understand was what was the purpose of injecting contrast?
Yes, so
you said that basically makes identification of the circuits more difficult, and it produces a lot of artifacts that otherwise wouldn't be there.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. In our animal work, we used that injection of contrast to confirm that we had the needle in the tissue. So, and also it confirms for us that we're not in the epicardium, because when you inject contrast in, you don't see the contrast appear in the pericardial space. And it also confirms that we haven't inserted the needle into a blood vessel. So we see that the contrast doesn't stream away down a coronary vessel. So we thought it was a safety, something that would improve the safety of the needle. And when we went to the FDA to get permission to do human cases, we included that in the protocol. We would inject and assess the effect of the saline contrast for safety issue. So unfortunately now I think we know a bit more about it. We probably don't need to do that just to confirm we're in issue, but our protocol right now still mandates it. And that's something when we go back to the FDA, like with the stays, that I think we'll want to give us the option to insert the needle but not inject until we know that we want to ablate, because I think it does introduce these other issues that we've talked about.
Follow-up question. Is it possible to inject something that can actually be used to do ablation? Like, for instance, if you imagine injecting contrast that's not necessarily contrast, but, you know, injecting liquid that's heated.
Yes. So some years ago, one of the folks at Penn, I think Dave Callens, did some injections, open chest with a needle, injecting alcohol into the myocardium for direct ablation. And the thing that concerns me about that is seeing this variable distribution of contrast that we get. That I think what you could do is inject a bit of contrast, and if you see that it goes where you want, then follow that with injection of a substance that might directly ablate the tissue. But it is interesting how variable the dispersion of the injectate is in tissue.
Thank you.
More questions? Thank you, Bill. Thanks, Bill.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I wish I was there with you guys.
Thanks for speaking.